Paramedic here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Donald Trump could theoretically evict the, you know, if he doesn't like CNN's coverage, he could say that they're no longer allowed to broadcast on the North Lawn, right?
And you think because it's a TV network, if that happens, that the Correspondents Association would take a stronger stance than they have with, say, the AP?
I think they probably would, but it would certainly raise a lot of questions. Would Fox News join? What would they exactly do? I'm not really sure, but I think it would, you would see a much more robust response if one of the television networks was barred.
So I want to begin by talking about Eugene Daniels, the embattled leader of the White House Correspondents Association. You've done some reporting around him and the association between banning the AP from the press pool, deciding which outlets could be in the press pool. The White House has taken a pretty firm stance really against press freedom when it comes to the White House Correspondents Association. Do you think Eugene has done a good job, and do you think he has the right strategy when it comes to dealing with this White House?
Well, I think there's no doubt that certain people, factions, and not an insignificant swath of the White House Correspondents Association is frustrated by the way the Correspondents Association has responded to this assault on the press. They would like to see a much more aggressive response. You know, obviously, the White House Correspondents Association under Daniels has issued many, many statements. But I think that there is a desire for something more. Members that I've talked to also feel like there wasn't really a lot of planning ahead of time to deal with these scenarios, even though they seemed fairly predictable. All that said, I am somewhat, you know, understanding of Daniels' position here, which is that he is representative of a very broad group. And, you know, it's not only CNN and ABC News and NBC News in it, but there's also Fox News in the White House Correspondents Association. I think the Daily Caller, the Washington Examiner, some right-leaning outlets or outright right-wing MAGA outlets are part of the association. And so when he's working to come up with a response, you have to keep in mind that he has to probably get, you know, Fox News to sign off on the response so that the White House Correspondents Association can be a unified body going to the White House. And I think even outside Fox News and some of those conservative outlets, I'm not really sure how aggressive, you know, the other outlets want to be either, because especially the TV outlets, because they probably don't want to lose access. And so from Daniels' perspective, probably it's, you know, I'm sure if all the members were saying, let's go DEFCON 1, he would be there with them. I think the challenge he's facing is not all of his members are on board with that, and he's trying to thread a very difficult needle.
But don't you think there's a balance between trying to please everyone in the press corps and at the end of the day taking a firm stance, standing up to the White House? And do you feel like, he, you know, between, I think of, you know, canceling the Amber Ruffin from the correspondence dinner. To me, it felt like a cowardly move, but I guess to others, it made sense given the way that the White House has treated the press and just making jokes about, you know, DC wouldn't necessarily be right for the moment. But don't you think he could be a little bit firmer?
I certainly think that the Correspondents Association can be a lot firmer, and I think that it's a little worrisome that they don't seem to be mounting any sort of, you know, response to the White House's unrelenting assault on them. I'm just thinking about it pragmatically, I guess, and that Daniels is a representative, I think, of a larger issue, which is that a lot of the press does not want to take that very aggressive stance, and it probably they won't until one of the television outlets, frankly, is picked on. I mean, I think if you think about the White House Correspondents Association, it's sort of like the UN, and the TV correspondents are sort of like the Security Council. They're the big players. And until one of those guys is picked on, until, you know, Trump says that CNN is banned from the Oval Office or ABC News is kicked out of an event, it's hard to imagine the TV networks getting involved. And when the TV networks aren't getting involved, you know, I don't know how much leverage the Correspondents Association has against the president. And I don't think that Daniels, frankly, can tell CNN or ABC or CBS, we're going to boycott, because I'm not really sure they're on board with that. So I think Daniels, I guess, is representative of a larger issue and a larger collective action problem that's probably out of his control to a large degree. Now, I would like it to, I personally would love to see him take a stronger stance. It's just that, you know, when you are a representative of a organization, your members, likely a lot of them, I think more of them than Fox News, you know, it's not just a Fox News issue. I think that it's, you know, it's very challenging.
And you alluded to it just now, but, you know, I would argue that the coverage of Trump has been a little bit softer than it was during the first administration. Some outlets do seem to be pulling their punches. Why do you think that is?
For a lot of reasons. I think a major motivating factor these days is the ownership of a lot of these media companies. And, you know, whether it's the Washington Post owned by Jeff Bezos, you know, or the Los Angeles Times owned by Patrick Soon-Shiong, or whether it's CNN owned by Warner Brothers Discovery, or CBS owned by Paramount Global, or, you know, you go down the list, you know, pretty much every news organization is owned by a much larger entity. And those large entities, whether they're corporate conglomerates or billionaire owners, they'll have different things at play. And so if you're Jeff Bezos, you know, your interests are maybe not aligned entirely with the Washington Post interest, because you're trying to score government contracts. You're trying to, you know, your Blue Origin company could be in danger of losing out to SpaceX if the Washington Post coverage is a certain way. And so when you factor that in, I think it starts to make a little more sense why these companies are walking on eggshells. And then you have to keep in mind, too, that on the television side, a lot of these companies are eyeing deals. They want to get bigger because they're, you know, Netflix upended their business model, and the only way they can survive is by basically getting bigger and bigger by doing more mergers and more acquisitions. And those are going to need, you know, probably some government approval. I mean, look what's happening with CBS News and Paramount Global and Skydance. Paramount Global owns CBS News. They want to merge with Skydance. And Brendan Carr at the FCC, he needs to sign off on this, and he's basically not. He's not over that 60 Minutes issue with Donald Trump. And so you can see and understand maybe why newsrooms are under pressure by their owners to maybe not be as aggressive as the moment calls for, because the ownership has all sorts of agendas at play, and you know, provoking Donald Trump when he's made it clear he will retaliate is not at the top of the list.
And it's clear he'll retaliate. We've seen it with the law firms and the EOs. Have you given any thought to the next wave of these EOs beyond law firms? I think it's inevitable that he'll start targeting media companies. You know, from people you've spoken to and just using your own imagination, what do you think those EOs could look like? And what sort of punishment could media companies face?
Well, I mean, he's already exacting some or pressuring media companies to settle a lot of these lawsuits that he filed, which were, you know, pretty universally derided by legal experts as ridiculous. So just look how much pressure there is on CBS and Paramount to settle the 60 Minutes lawsuits, even though, you know, you ask pretty much any legal expert worth their salt and they'll say this is a ridiculous lawsuit, it's absurd. But there's a lot of pressure on them to do that. And I think that Donald Trump can do a lot of, I mean, he can do a lot of things. He can, you know, when you talk about the White House Correspondents Association, for instance, I think one of the things that these outlets are thinking is like, let's not make it worse. So like Donald Trump could theoretically evict the, you know, if he doesn't like CNN's coverage, he could say that they're no longer allowed to broadcast on the North Lawn, right?
And you think, because it's a TV network, if that happens, that the Correspondents Association would take a stronger stance than they have with, say, the AP?
I think they probably would, but it would certainly raise a lot of questions. Would Fox News join, you know, everyone else in that potential boycott? Like, what would they exactly do? I'm not really sure, but I think you would see a much more robust response if one of the television networks was barred. I think, you know, they all support, you know, HuffPost and the AP in writing, but I just think a television network is going to generate much more, you know, much more robust response. But, you know, that's one of the things he could do, Donald Trump. You know, I think there's a real concern that, you know, if the White House or the administration goes looking for sources, that they could try to potentially raid a newsroom and say they
right.
have information that's, you know, that's relevant to our investigation and demand that be turned over. And we've already seen this actually happen.
Todd Blanche, by the way, threatened an investigation, I think, related to the El Salvador deportations. You know, I forget which case, but he's threatened to look into who was leaking.
And we've already seen local newsrooms get raided by overzealous police officers. So, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to me if, you know, you see Dan Bongino and the FBI or whatever at one of these newsrooms demanding equipment, demanding information. And so those are just a couple ways, though, that Donald Trump can pick on the press. I mean, there's a lot of things that he can do. And even just controlling, by the way, the White House, the pool. I mean, right now it's sort of operating like it did before under the Correspondents Association, except the AP and HuffPost aren't being granted access. But let's say something serious happens, like the president gets COVID again or something. I don't know. He got COVID last time, and that was a serious issue. He was airlifted, you know, over to Walter Reed. Would the White House then restrict access to outlets like OAN and Newsmax because they control the pool now? We don't really know what would happen. And so I think that I don't know. I think there's a lot of worrisome things the president can do, and also we haven't even talked about what's going on in the Pentagon. But they're clearly setting the stage to exert more control over the press.
Totally. And when the New York Times had the piece that Elon Musk was set to receive a briefing at the Pentagon, I think the next day Musk said he wanted to launch an investigation into who had leaked the story, which must, you know, be, you know, it'll definitely have a chilling effect, I think. On future career employees or even political employees who want to talk to the press to speak out against the craziness that they perceive to be happening. From the people that you've spoken to, you're friends with a lot of White House correspondents and people in DC. Are they having a tougher time penetrating the Trump administration and the officials inside of that of the administration than they did during the first administration?
I think there's really no doubt that the first administration was a lot. I mean, I don't want to make this administration seem like it's not clumsy, given the very obvious things they've done recently, like adding Jeffrey Goldberg to a group chat. So we don't want to give too much credit for these guys. It's not like they're real professional operators like you would normally see in the White House. But I think that the first administration was just so off the rails in terms of like chaos in the West Wing that this administration seems a little bit more cleaned up and you know, just relative to that first administration. But I think you're still seeing a lot of, you know, scoops emerge from the West Wing. Think about the Laura Loomer story, for instance, last week,
right,
where Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan and Kent Bissinger went inside and were able to basically be in the room for that meeting the way they told it. And they reported out that Laura Loomer had had advised Trump to get rid of all these NSC officials, and he followed suit. And so I think you're still seeing a lot of those stories. I'd also point out, too, that it just seems that, like, so much of the public is desensitized to these wild stories that we're seeing.
Agreed.
You know, that, like, it might have seemed like that maybe the press was getting more the first time around because every story was just so shocking. But now the Trump tweets, the idea that Laura Loomer's in the West Wing alone several years ago would have generated a lot more attention.
Ten days of headlines.
Yeah, not even thinking about or mentioning the part that she actually got NSC officials fired. And now it's just sort of another headline, another story that's part of the tsunami of stories out of DC. And so that might be also, I think, impacting the idea that the press isn't getting as much.
Today, the big story in DC is tariffs. How do you think it'll affect media companies, not newsrooms, but their parent companies, Netflix, Warner Brothers Discovery, Disney?
I think it's going to be serious. I mean, I think that any company that uses or relies on any advertising revenue is going to have to probably scale back spending. I mean, I reported last week, I mean, a company like Disney is so big. So Bob Iger he hopped on the ABC News editorial call last week, and he told employees that these tariffs are going to have an impact on the company, and they might need to scale back spending. And he pointed out, for instance, that they're building two new cruise ships at Disney, and those cruise ships use a lot of steel. And
I thought that was fascinating, that scoop.
Thank you. And so that's just a very obvious way in which costs of Disney will rise. But outside even a company like Disney, I think newsrooms, I've talked to news leaders who are saying that they're very worried about the economic environment right now, because even if the tariffs, get reduced, this uncertainty that Donald Trump has cast over the country, and frankly, the world, that's putting a real chill in the air. And businesses don't like operating and investing when they're not sure what the policies of the U.S. are going to be like 60 days from now. And so that's a huge, huge issue, I think, for not only media companies or businesses. And if you're talking about media companies, most media companies, they rely on advertising revenue. Even the ones like the New York Times, which has a huge subscriber base, they still have rely on advertising revenue. That's factored into budgets. And so if the tariffs go into place and companies like Nike no longer have as much of a marketing spend because they're having to eat costs of tariffs, that's going to impact media companies that rely on those advertising dollars. And the first thing that usually goes when the company needs to save money is a marketing budget. And that's really going to be tough, I think, for a lot of media companies.
One of the companies that's inevitably going to be safer is Status. You guys have a lot of subscribers. I'm curious, your breakdown between, I don't know if you've divulged it, but is your revenue mostly from subscribers as opposed to advertisers?
Yeah. I mean, the vast majority of our revenue is from subscribers. And so I think that definitely makes us a little bit more safe in this environment. But I don't know. I think no one can say that anyone's safe in this environment that we're going into, because no one knows what kind of economic environment the U.S. is going to be in, the world's going to be in 60 to 90 days. I mean, if the globe slides into a recession, even companies that rely on subscribers are going to probably have a little bit of trouble, because people are going to lose their jobs. And when people lose their jobs, obviously they cut down dramatically on spending. Even when people are still employed and the environment is unstable, they start to look at their wallets and they stop spending, and consumer confidence goes down. And so, I talked to one media executive last week that said and pointed out that even these subscription-based companies, are going to struggle if the economic situation deteriorates, because whether it's spending that extra money on Max or Paramount Plus or Disney Plus, or whether it's spending that extra money on the extra news subscription or newsletter that you just subscribed to, people do cut back during tough times. And so while these subscription-based companies might be a little bit more immune, I think it's still going to present challenges.
I think that's totally right. I spend so much money on email newsletters, and even I am pausing now when I take a look at new ones to subscribe to. You were one of the early journalists in this latest wave to go independent. How has it been, and what's it been like? And tell me about the decision to go with Beehive as opposed to Substack.
Yeah, I mean, it's been phenomenal. I mean, I have been overwhelmed by support doing this, and you it's a really big leap of faith. So when you first go independent, you're starting from zero. You have zero subscription revenue, and it's not like overnight where you are making a decent amount of money to even fill your CNN salary, in my case. And so it was scary, but I was overwhelmed by support, and I've been I'm really thrilled by the response that people have shown and subscribing to Status and offering support. And so that's been really amazing. In terms of Beehive versus Substack, I think, you know, both platforms are frankly great, and they offer different things. I think that for me, and for Status, I wanted Status to have a unique look and feel. And that wasn't something that Substack was offering when I was launching. I think they actually have started launching their own, like, I think they call it like an enterprise plan, which is like Bari Weiss is the first one to have it, where she has a custom website and it doesn't look...
Her site looks good, yes.
Yeah, it's built on Substack. It's like built, it's powered by Substack, I guess is the way they phrase it, but it doesn't look like it's a Substack, which is really cool. But for anyone on Beehive has access to that. So we have a custom website. Everything is really branded as Status, being the number one brand there. And that was really important as I think we got up and running, that we're not a sub brand, but we're the main brand. And I want people to think and see Status as an independent company. Frankly, the way even, you know, you think about the Free Press, I don't think anyone thinks of that as a Substack. They just think of it as the Free Press because it has its own unique branding. And so that was the reason, one of the main drivers with going for Beehive.
The 75,000 subscriber number that was bandied about in the Wall Street Journal, that is both paying and free?
Yes, that is. If we had 75,000 paid subscribers,
you wouldn't waste your time with me. You'd be on a yacht.
We'd be, I don't know about a yacht, but we'd certainly have a more robust newsroom, because I do want to eventually continue to expand Status beyond myself. No, so 75,000, I think it was 70,000 we said. We have surpassed 75,000 though.
Good. That's our little scoop from this podcast.
Yes. Those are free and paid. And we're on track to, do seven figures in annual recurring revenue in 2025. So that's very exciting. We're in a good spot there, I'd say. And we're trying to grow. We haven't taken any investor money. And so we're growing organically and slowly been trying to evaluate what we need. And so we just hired John Passantino as the executive editor a couple months ago in February, late February. And hopefully we can keep adding to the team as we grow. We're just doing so really responsibly, particularly again in this economic climate, because we're not backed by any giant corporation or anything.
Can we talk about the Wall Street Journal piece for a second? It was so good, and I was so happy for you. I read in a different newsletter that Rupert Murdoch was upset by it. Is that right?
That is what I've heard as well. Which Breaker, the newsletter by Lachlan Cartwright and Ravi, that's what they reported, that he was, I think, livid over the piece and made it clear to Emma Tucker, the Wall Street Journal executive editor or editor in chief, that he was very upset that it ran in his newspaper. And apparently, according to, you know, Lachlan and Ravi, I don't have this reporting myself, but they obtained emails, internal correspondence inside the journal where Emma ordered the story then to be what she referred to as desurfaced, which I guess is like taking it off the homepage, making sure it's not on social media, things like that. And, that apparently dumbfounded some people inside the journal, because it was, strangely, I'd say, one of the top read stories in the Wall Street Journal that day. I don't even know, honestly, what to make of it. I knew that Rupert's probably not a big fan, but the fact that he would go through such lengths, I think, shows that we might be living in his head a little bit.
I'm curious, do you know, is he a subscriber to Status, even though he hates it?
I don't believe he is personally a subscriber. I'm sure, clearly, obviously, he's aware of it, right? So I don't know if people send him stuff or if he's has a secret email. You know, a lot of people too, by the way, they have very strange emails, very covert emails. And so it's very difficult. Some people have first name, last name emails. A lot of people have these, you know, Andrew, I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, hidden emails, and it's very difficult. They're like weird AOL accounts or weird Yahoo accounts, and you don't even know who they are, and they're subscribing. And so,
do you have your guesses?
Occasionally, but some of them are so. You would be surprised if you looked at like an email list. It's not like this neat thing where you can really tell who a lot of the people are. I'd say like you know, 60% of it, it's like you would have, it's not first name, last name. It's strange stuff. So, you know, we don't actually, I wish I could say we don't know in a lot of cases who's subscribing, because they have, a lot of people have weird emails.
Well, I'm glad that a lot of weird emails are subscribing to Status, and I'm wishing you continued success in the years ahead. Oliver, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Andrew.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.